They wound up in the middle of a rutted dirt road while reflecting that many more of that sort would not improve his appearance. He patted his pockets, especially an extra pocket concealed by the bib of his overalls, and decided that nothing was missing. He missed the comfort of a blaster on his hip, but knew that any sort of gun would be a mistake for this time and place. A facsimile jackknife was all he carried. His hat? The ditch? No. 10 feet inside the fence, which might as well be 10 miles. The bull was keeping an eye on him. A hat was not necessary. If anyone found it and noticed that it was not quite right, well, there was nothing to connect it with him. Forget it. North Star again. That town should be about 5 miles down this road, straight as the turtle flies. He set out. Lazarus stood in front of the print shop of the Dade County Democrat, looking at sheets posted inside the glass, but not reading. He was thinking. He had just had a shock, and the pretense of continuing to read posted newspapers let him do so in quiet. He had read a date and now needed to reconstruct some ancient history. August 1st, 1916. 1916. He saw reflected in the glass a figure coming down the sidewalk, heavy-set, middle-aged, wearing a gun belt almost concealed by belly overflowing it, a holstered hog leg on his right thigh, star on his left breast, otherwise dressed much as Lazarus was dressed. Lazarus continued to stare at a posted front page of the Kansas City Journal. Morning. Lazarus turned. Good morning, Chief. Just a constable, son. Stranger hereabouts? Yes. Passing through? Or staying with someone? Passing through, unless I find work. That's a good answer. What trade do you follow? I was raised on a farm, but I'm an all-around mechanic. For anything for an honest dollar. Well, I'll tell you, not many farmers taking on hands right now. As for anything else, things are slow in the summertime. You wouldn't be one of them IWWs, would you? IW what? A wobbly, son. Don't you read the papers? This is a friendly community, always glad to have visitors, but not that sort. The local law raised one hand to wipe away sweat and gave a large recognition sign. Lazarus knew how to answer it and decided not to. Where was his home lodge? That's a good question. Officer, so let's not let it come up. The constable went on. Well, since you're not one, you're welcome to ask around and see if somebody needs help. He looked at the front page Lazarus had been pretending to read. Terrible what those U-boats are doing, isn't it? Lazarus agreed that it was. Still, the officer added, if people stayed home and minded their own business, it wouldn't happen. Live and let live, I always say. What church do you attend? Well, my folks are Presbyterians. So, meaning you haven't attended lately? Well, sometimes I miss myself when the fish are biting. But, see that church up the street? The belfry through the elms? If you do find work, why, come Sunday 10 o'clock, let me extend you the right hand of fellowship there. Methodist Episcopal. But, there ain't all that much difference. This is a tolerant community. Yeah, thank you, sir. I'll be there. Good, very tolerant. Mostly Methodists and Baptists, but a few Jack Mormons on the farms around here. Good neighbors. They always pay their bills. A few Catholics, and nobody holds it against them. Why, we've even got a Jew. Sounds like a good town. It is. Local option and clean living. Just one thing. If you don't find work, About half a mile beyond the church, you'll find a city limit sign. If you're unemployed and have no local address, it's best to be on the other side of it come sundown. I see. Or I would have to run you in. No hard feelings, that's just the way it is. No tramps and niggers after sundown. I don't make the rules, son. I just enforce them. And that's how Judge Mostella defines a tramp. Some of our good ladies have been pushing him. Things stolen off clotheslines and the like. So it's $10 or 10 days, which isn't too bad, as the lockup is right in my house. The food's not fancy, as I'm allowed only 40 cents a day to board a prisoner. Though for 50 cents more, you can eat what we do. No intention of making things hard, you understand. It's just that the judge and the mayor aim to keep this a quiet, law-abiding place. I understand. Certainly no hard feelings, because you won't have occasion to lock me up. Glad to hear it. Any way I can help you, son, just let me know. Thank you. Perhaps you can right now. Do you know of an outhouse a stranger might use? Or had I better try to hold it until I'm out of town and can find some bushes? The officer smiled. Oh, I think we can be that hospitable. The courthouse has a real city-type flush toilet. But it's not working. Let me think. Blacksmith down this way sometimes accommodates automobilists passing through. I'll walk down with you. That's mighty kind of you. Glad to. Better tell me your name. Ted Bronson. The blacksmith was trimming a hoof on a young gelding. He looked up. Hi, Deacon. Howdy, Tom. This young friend of mine, Ted Bronson, has a case of Kansas Quickstep. Could he use your privy? The blacksmith looked Lazarus over. Help yourself, Ted. Try not to go clear back to the harness section. Thank you, sir. Lazarus followed the path behind the shop, was pleased to find that the privy had a door with no cracks and could be hooked from the inside. He got out the extra pocket hidden by the bib of his overalls, took out money. Paper banknotes convincing in every detail. There were restored replications of originals in the Museum of Ancient History in New Rome. Counterfeit by definition, but the restorations were so perfect that Lazarus would not hesitate to utter them in any bank, except for one thing. What dates did they carry? He quickly shuffled the paper money into two packs, 1916 and earlier, and post-1916. Then without hesitating or stopping to count, he shoved the usable banknotes into a pocket, tore a page from the Montgomery Ward catalog in the Cobb box, packaged the useless bills so that they would not be spotted as money, dropped the package into the cesspool. Then he got out coins, still in that secret pocket, checked their dates. He noted that most of them carried damning mint dates. These followed the paper money. He wasted a full second admiring a proof-perfect replica buffalo nickel. Such a pretty thing. He gave sober thought, at least 2 seconds, to a massive $20 gold piece. Gold was gold. Its value would not be diminished if he melted it down or pounded it into a shapeless lump. But it was a hazard until he could deface it, as the next town clown might not be as friendly as this one. Down it went. He felt lighthearted then. Queer money was a serious offense here. Good for a number of years in prisons, unpleasant and difficult to escape from. But lack of money was a correctable nuisance. Lazarus had considered arriving with no money at all, then had compromised by taking enough for a few days to let him look around, reorient, get used to the customs and the lingo again, before having to scratch for a living. He had never considered trying to fetch enough to last 10 years. Never mind. This was more fun. In good practice for the much harder job of tackling an era he had never known. Elizabethan England. That would be a real challenge. He counted what he had left. $3.87. Not bad. The blacksmith said, Thought you'd fallen in. Feel better? Much better. Thanks a lot. Don't mention it. Deacon Ames says you claim to be a mechanic. I'm handy with tools. Ever work in a smithy? Yes. Let me see your hands. Lazarus let his palms be inspected. The blacksmith said, "City feller." Lazarus made no comment. Or maybe you got those soft hands in the cooler? I suppose that could count for it. Thanks again for the use of your facilities. Wait a jiffy. 30 cents an hour and you do what I tell you, and I may fire you after the first hour. Okay. Know anything about automobiles? Some. See if you can get that Tin Lizzie moving. The smith jerked his head toward the far side of his shop. Lazarus went outside, looked over the Ford runabout he had noted there earlier. Its turtleback had been removed, and a wooden box had been fitted to convert it into a pickup truck. Its wheel spokes showed signs of muddy roads, but it appeared to be in fair condition. He removed the front seat, checked the gasoline with a dipstick he found there, half a tank. He checked the water, added some from the shop's pump, then opened the hood and inspected the engine. The lead from magneto to coil box was not attached. He reconnected it. He set the handbrake, decided that it was not very firm, so he blocked the wheels. Only then did he switch on ignition, open the throttle, and retard the spark. He cautiously tucked his thumb by his fingers rather than around the crank, then brought the crank up high, pushed, and spun it. The motor racketed. The little car shook. He rushed to the driver's side of the car, reached in and advanced the spark 3 notches, and eased the throttle to idle. The smith was watching. All right, turn it off, and come give me some wind on the forge. Neither of them mentioned the disconnected lead. When the smith, Tom Hyman's, stopped to eat lunch, Lazarus walked 2 blocks to a grocery store he had passed, bought a quart of grade A raw milk, 5 cents, 3 cents deposit on the bottle, looked at a nickel loaf of bread, then decided to splurge on a big dime loaf. He had had no breakfast. He walked back to the blacksmith shop and greatly enjoyed his lunch while he listened to Mr. Hyman's opinions. He was a progressive Republican, but this time he was going to switch. Mr. Wilson had kept us out of war. Not that he's done the country any good otherwise. The high cost of living is worse than ever. And besides that, he's pro-British. But that fool Hughes would have us in the European war overnight. It's a hard choice. I'd like to vote for La Follette, but they don't have sense enough to nominate him. Germany's going to win, and he knows it. And we'd look pretty silly trying to pull England's chestnuts out of the fire. Lazarus agreed solemnly. Hyman's told Ted to show up at 7 the next morning. But just before sundown, almost $3 richer and his stomach well padded with sausage, cheese, and crackers, Lazarus was beyond the city limits sign and moving west. He had nothing against the town or the blacksmith, but he had not risked this trip to spend 10 years in a country town at 30 cents an hour. He intended to stir around, recapture the flavor of the time. Besides, Hyman's had been too inquisitive. Lazarus had not minded the inspection of his hands, or the suggestion that he might be fresh out of jail, and the disconnected wire was a standoff. But when Lazarus had parried a question about his accent with generalities, the smith had tried to pin him down to just where in Indian Territory he had lived as a child, and when did his folks come down from Canada. A larger community meant fewer personal questions and more opportunities to lay hands on more than 30 cents an hour without quite stealing it. He had been walking an hour when he came across a stranded automobilist, an old country doctor playing with a flat tire on a Maxwell. Lazarus dismounted a coal oil sidelight and had the physician hold it while he patched the tube, replaced the tire, and pumped it up, then refused to tip. Dr. Chaddock said,
"Red, do you know how to drive these gas
tube?" Replaced the tire and pumped it up, then refused to tip. Dr. Chaddock said,
"Red, do you know how to drive these gas buggies?"
Lazarus admitted that he did.
"Well, son, since you're headed west anyhow, what would you say to driving me to Lamar, then a shakedown on the couch in my waiting room, breakfast, and 4 bits to boot for your trouble?"
"I say yes to all of it, doctor. Save that there's no need to waste cash on me. I'm not broke."
"Stuff and nonsense. Argue about it in the morning. I'm plumb tuckered out. This day started before daybreak. Used to be I'd wind the reins around the whip and nap until the mare got us home. But these things are stupid."
After a breakfast of fried eggs, fried ham, fried potatoes, pancakes with sorghum and country butter, watermelon preserves, strawberry preserves, cream that would barely pour, an endless coffee, saucered and blowed, the doctor's housekeeper, his old maid sister, had kept plying Lazarus, insisting that he wasn't eating enough to keep a bird alive. He set out again, a dollar richer, much cleaner, and looking less like a hayseed, for spit and shinola and elbow grease had improved the appearance of his shoes, and Miss Nettie had insisted on giving him some old clothes.
"Might as well be you, Roderick, as the Salvation Army. Here, take this tie, too. Dog doesn't wear it anymore. Look neat when you look for work, I always say. I do declare I won't hardly open the screen door to give a man a handout if he don't wear a necktie."
He accepted it all, aware that she was right, aware also that Dr. Chaddock would have spent a bad night trying to sleep in his automobile while his sister worried had not Lazarus come along. Accounts balanced. Miss Nettie made a neat bundle of his old clothes. He thanked her and promised to send them a postcard from Kansas City. Then he abandoned the bundle in the first bushes he came to, feeling mild regret as those clothes would wear indefinitely despite the worn look built into them. But they were slightly anachronistic in cut, and he had never expected to wear them longer than he had to, and a man on the road could not afford to look like a bindle stiff, which Miss Nettie probably didn't know. He found the railroad, but avoided the depot. He posted himself at the north edge of town and waited. A passenger train and a freight headed south went by. Then about 10 o'clock, a freight showed up heading north and still slowly gathering speed. Lazarus swung aboard. He made no effort not to be seen and let the brakeman shake him down for a dollar, a replica dollar. His authentic dollars were now under a bandage on the inside of his left thigh. The brakeman warned him that there might be a railroad dick at the next stop. Don't give him more than a dollar, and there were Pinkertons in the KC Yards if he was going that far, so don't. Those beauties would take his dollar and work him over anyhow. Lazarus thanked him and thought about asking what line this was, the Missouri Pacific, but decided that it did not matter. It was headed north, and the brakeman's advice let him know that it was going far enough to suit him. After a long, hot day, half of it in a gondola, half in an empty boxcar, that was small improvement, Lazarus dropped off as that train passed through Swope Park. He was such a weary, dirty mess that he almost regretted not having bought a ticket. But he put it out of his thoughts, knowing that arriving in a city with no money could wind up as $30 or 30 days instead of the milder tariff of a small town. As it was, he had almost $6, most of it real money. He noted with delight that Swope Park looked familiar, despite the centuries. Hurried on through and found the end of the Swope Park streetcar line. While he waited for the infrequent weekday service, he paid a jitney for a triple-dip ice cream cone and ate it with relish, peace in his soul. Another 5 cents and a long trolley ride, with one transfer, took him into downtown Kansas City. Lazarus enjoyed every minute and wished it were longer. How peaceful and clean and tree-shaded the city was. How gently bucolic.
He recalled another time he had visited his old hometown. What century? Sometime early in the diaspora, he thought, when a citizen venturing out into its filthy canyon streets wore a steel helmet simulating a wig, a bulletproof vest and codpiece, spectacles that were armor, gloves that covered brass knuckles and other concealed and illegal weapons, but rarely went out into the streets. It was more discreet to stick to transportation pods and go outdoors only in the guarded suburbs, especially after dark. But here and now, guns were legal, and no one wore them. He got off the streetcar at McGee, found the YMCA by asking a policeman. There, for half a dollar, he was given a key to a small cubicle, a towel, and a small bar of soap. After wallowing in the shower, Lazarus returned to the lobby, having noted both Bell and Home telephones at the desk, with a notice, local calls 5 cents, pay the desk clerk. He asked to use the telephone books. Found it in the Bell system book. Chapman, Bowles, and Finnegan, attorneys at law. R.A. Long Building. Yes, that made sense. He searched again. Found Chapman, Arthur J., attorney, with a Paseo address. Wait till tomorrow? No harm in seeing if Justin had the correct answers. He slid a nickel to the desk clerk, asked for the Bell telephone. Number, please. Central, please give me Atwater, 1224. Hello? Is this the home of Mr. Arthur J. Chapman, the attorney? This is he. Mr. Ira Howard told me to call you, counselor. Interesting. Who are you? Life is short, but the years are long, the lawyer answered. Not while the evil days come not. Very well. What can I do for you, sir? Trouble? No, sir. Will you accept an envelope to be delivered to the secretary of the foundation? Yes. Can you bring it to my office? Tomorrow morning, sir? Say about 9:30. I must be in court by 10. Thank you, sir. I'll be there. Good night. You are welcome. Good night to you, sir. There was a writing desk in the lobby, with another notice to see the desk clerk, along with a homily. Have you written to your mother this week? Lazarus asked for a sheet of paper and an envelope, saying, truthfully, that he wanted to write home. The clerk gave them to him. That's what we like to hear, Mr. Jenkins. Sure one sheet was enough? If not, I'll ask for another, thanks. After breakfast, coffee and a donut, 5 cents, Lazarus located a stationery shop on Grand Avenue and invested 15 cents in 5 envelopes that would nest in series. Went back to the Y and repaired them, then delivered them by hand to Mr. Chapman, despite pursed-lip disapproval of Mr. Chapman's secretary. The outer envelope read, Secretary of the Ira Howard Foundation. The next one read, To the Secretary of the Howard Families Association, as of the year 2100 A.D. The next one read, Please hold in the family's archives for 1,000 years. Inert atmosphere recommended. The fourth read, To be opened by the chief archivist in office in Gregorian year 4291. The fifth envelope read, Please deliver on request to Lazarus Long or to any member of his Tertius colony family. Inside this envelope was the envelope from the YMCA enclosing the note Lazarus had written the night before. The envelope had on it all the names of his boondock family, with Lapis Lazuli and Lorelei Lee heading the list. 4 August, 1916 Gregorian. Darlings, I goofed. I arrived 2 days ago, 3 years early. But I still want you to pick me up exactly 10 T years after you drop me at the impact crater
i.e. 2 August 1926, Gregorian. Please assure Dora that this is not her fault. It is either mine or Andy's, or perhaps the instruments we had available then were not sufficiently accurate. If Dora wants to recalibrate, not necessary, as exactly 10 T-years from drop remains the rendezvous. Tell her to get Eclipses of Sol by Luna for this 10 years from Athene. I haven't had time to look them up as I have just reached Kansas City. Everything is absolutely all right. I am in good health, have enough money, and am perfectly safe. I'll write other and longer letters. Better preserved. No time to have this one etched. Using all the mail drops Justin suggested. Kiss everyone for me. Long letter follows. My undying love, old buddy boy. P.S. I hope it's a boy and a girl. Wouldn't that be fun? Da Capo, 2. The End of an Era. 25 September 1916, Gregorian. Dear Laz Lor, this is the second of many letters I will attempt to send, using all the delay mail drops Justin suggested. Three law firms, Chase National Bank, a time capsule to be forwarded with instructions to a Dr. Gordon Hardy via W.W. Smith, via a safe deposit box, unreliable coot, that Smith. He'll probably open it and thereby destroy it, although I don't recall it either way. And all the other dodges I memorized. If I can get just one into the archives just before the diaspora, it should be delivered when you ask for it. Late. In Gregorian 4291, by the schedule we worked out. With luck, you will receive dozens of letters, all at the same time, arranged by dates. They should constitute a record of the next 10 years. There may be gaps in the account, letters that failed to get through. If so, I'll fill in those gaps after you pick me up, by dictating to Athene. To keep my promise to Justin and to Galahad for a full report. Me? I'll be satisfied if just one gets through. And tell Athene to keep working on that notion of time capsule come delay mail for still earlier centuries. There ought to be some way to make it foolproof. I'll be using a wide variety of addresses, plus a wrinkle I thought up. I'm going to send a letter in the usual multiple covers to the executive computer, Secundus, year 2000, Diaspora, to be opened by and read by the computer, untouched by human hands, with a program to hold the message and deliver it to the colony leader, Tertius, the day after we left. I don't believe in paradoxes. Either Minerva got that message before you were born and filed it in dead storage and passed it on to Athene, and now, you're now, Ira has it and has passed it on to you two, or it failed to get through at all. No anomaly, no paradox. Either total success or total failure. I got the idea from the fact that the executive computer opens and reads and acts on endless written messages without referring them to the chairman pro tem or to any human unless necessary. Basic message. This was in my first note and will be in every letter. I made an error in calibration and arrived 3 years early. This is not Dora's fault. And be sure to tell her I said so before you tell her what happened. Reassure her. Despite her tomboy rowdiness, she is very vulnerable and must not be hurt. If I had given her sufficiently accurate figures, she would have hit any split second I asked for. Of this I am certain. Basic rendezvous time and place remains 10.00 T-years after you drop me, and at Meteor Impact Crater in Arizona. Other rendezvous times and places figured from basic as before. My error changes the Gregorian date of rendezvous to 2 August 1926, but still 10 T-years after drop is planned. If Dora will worry less, if she finds the error in the data I gave her, here are time marks she can rely on. Gregorian dates of total eclipses by Luna of Sol with respect to Terra between Gregorian 2, August 1916, and 2, August 1926. 1918, June 8th. 1919, May 29th.
1922, September 21st. 1923, September 10th. 1925, January 24th. 1926, January 14th. If Dora wants to be still fussier, she can get any ancient solar system date from Athene she wants. The Great Library at New Rome prepares any ancient solar system date from Athene she wants. The Great Library at New Rome perpetuated endless stuff of that sort, but Dora has, in her own gizzards, everything she really needs. Recapitulation. 1. Pick me up 10 T-years after you drop me. 2. I'm 3 years early, my era, not Dora's. 3. I'm fine, healthy, safe, holding, missing my darlings, and send love to all of you. Now the hairy and scary adventures of a time traveler. To begin with, they have been neither hairy nor scary. I've been careful to attract no attention, as retiring as a mouse at a cat show. Whenever the locals rub blue mud in their navels, I rub blue mud in mine just as solemnly. I agree with the politics of anyone who speaks to me, attend the church he does, while sheepishly admitting that I've missed lately. I listen instead of talking, difficult as you may find that to believe, and I never talk back. If someone tries to rob me, I will not kill him or even break his arms. I'll shut up and let him have all he can find on me. My fixed purpose is to be on the lip of that crater in Arizona 10 years from now. I shan't let anything jeopardize keeping our date. I'm not here to reform this world. I am simply revisiting the scenes of my childhood. It has been easier than I expected. Accent gave me some trouble at first, but I listened and now speak as harsh a cornbelt accent as I did as a youngster. It is amazing how things have come back. I confirm from experience the theory that childhood memories are permanent, even though one may forget them until re-stimulated. I left this city when I was younger than you two are. I have been on more than 200 planets since then. I have forgotten most of them, but I find that I know this city. Some changes, but changes in the other entropy direction. I'm now seeing it as it was when I was 4 T-years old. I am 4 years old elsewhere in this city. I have avoided that neighborhood and have not yet tried to see my first family. The idea makes me a bit uneasy. Oh, I shall before I leave to travel around the country. I'm not afraid of being recognized by them. Impossible. I looked like a young man and much, I think, as I looked when I was in fact a young man. But no one here has ever seen what that 4-year-old will look like when he grows up. My only hazard would lie in trying to tell the truth. Not that I would be believed. No one here believes even in space travel, much less time travel. But because I would risk being locked up as crazy, a non-scientific term meaning that the person to whom one applies that label has a world picture differing from the accepted one. Kansas City in 1916. You put me down in a meadow. I climbed the fence and walked to the nearest town. No one noticed us. Tell Dora that she did it slick as a pickpocket. The town was pleasant, the people friendly. I stayed a day to get reoriented, then moved on to a larger town. Did the same there, and got clothes to change me from a farm worker into someone who would not be conspicuous in a city. You dears who never wear clothes when you don't need them, except festive occasions, would have trouble believing how status here and now is shown by clothes. Far more so than in New Rome. Here one can look at a person and tell age, sex, social status, economic status, probable occupation, approximate education, and many other things just by clothing. These people even swim with clothes on. I am not farcing. Ask Athene. My dears, they sleep in clothes. I took a railroad train to Kansas City. Askathene needs to display a picture of one from this era. This culture is proto-technical, just beginning to shift from human muscle power and animal power to generated power, such as there is originates from burning natural fuels or from wind or waterfall. Some of this is converted into primitive electrical power, but this railroad train was propelled by burning coal to produce expanding steam. Atomic power is not even a theory. It is a fancy of dreamers, taken less seriously than Santa Claus. As for the method for moving the Dora, no one has the slightest notion that there is any way of grasping the fabric of space-time. I could be wrong. The many tales of UFOs and of strange visitors throughout all ages suggest that I am not the first time tripper by thousands or millions. But perhaps most of them are as reluctant to disturb the native savages as I am. On arrival in Kansas City, I took lodging at a religious Hilton. If you received my arrival note, it was on stationery bearing its emblem. I hope that note is the last I will have to entrust to paper and ink. But it took time to arrange for photo reduction and etching. The technology and materials available here and now are very primitive, even when I have privacy to use other techniques. As a temporary base, this religious Hilton offers advantages. It is cheap, and I have not yet had time to acquire all the local money I will need. It is clean and safe compared with commercial Hiltons costing the same. It is near the business district. It offers all that I now need and no more. And it is monastic. Monastic? Don't look surprised, my loves. I expect to remain celibate throughout these 10 years, while dreaming happy fantasies of all my darlings. So many years and light years away. Why? The local mores. Here, the coupling of male and female is forbidden by law, unless specifically licensed by the state in a binding monogamy with endless legal, social, and economic consequences. Such laws are made to be broken, and are. About 3 squares, or a few 100 meters from this monastic Hilton, the YMCA starts the red light district, an area devoted to illicit but tolerated female prostitution, and the fees are low. No, I am not too lazy to walk that far. I've talked to some of these women. They walk a beat, offering their services to men on the street. But, my dears, these women are not recognized artists, proud of their great vocation. Oh, dear, no. They are pathetic drabs, furtive and ashamed. They are at the bottom of the social pyramid, and many, most, are enthralled to males who take their meager earnings. I do not think there is a Tamra, or even a pseudo-Tamra, in all of Kansas City. Outside the red light district, there are younger and prettier women available for higher fees and by more complex arrangements, but their status is still zero. No proud and happy artists, so they are no temptation. I would not be able to put out of my mind the gruesome fashion in which they are mistreated under local laws and customs. I tip those I talk to. Time is money to them. Then there are women who are not of the profession. From my earlier life here, I know that a high percentage of both single women and married women, a sharp dichotomy, much sharper than on Tertius or even Secundus, many of these will chance unlicensed coupling for fun, adventure, love, or other reasons. Most women here are thus available sometimes and with some men, although not with all men, nor all the time. Here and now the sport is necessarily clandestine. Nor do I lack confidence, nor have I contracted the local moral attitude. But the answer is again no. Why? First reason, it is all too likely to get one's arse shot off. No joke, dears. Here and now, almost every female is quasi-property of some male. Husband, father, sweetheart, betrothed, someone. If he catches you, he may kill you, and public opinion is such that he is unlikely to be punished. But if you kill him, you hang by the neck until dead, dead, dead. It seems an excessive price. I don't plan to risk it. There are a small but appreciable number of females who are not property of some male. So what's holding you back, Lazarus? The overhead, for one thing. Better not tell Galahad this. It would break his heart. Negotiations are usually long, complex, and very expensive. And she is likely to regard success as equivalent to a proposal of lifetime contract. On top of that, she is quite likely to become pregnant. I should have asked Ishtar to offset my fertility for this trip. I am terribly glad I did not. And I am honing for you, darlings, my other selves, and thank you endlessly for kicking my feet out from under me. I couldn't initiate it, dearly as I wanted to. Laz and Lore believe this, but your females here do not know when they are fertile. They rely either on luck or on contraceptive methods that range from chancy to worthless. Furthermore, they can't find out even from their therapists, who don't know much about it themselves. They are not geneticists. Therapy is very primitive in 1916. Most physicians are trying hard, I think, but the art is barely out of the witch doctor stage. Just rough surgery and a few drugs, most of which I know to be useless or harmful. As for contraception, hold on tight. It is forbidden by law. Another law made to be broken, and is. But law and customs retard progress in such matters. At present, 1916, the commonest method involves an elastomer sheath worn by the male. In other words, they couple without touching. Stop screaming, you'll never have to put up with it. But it is as bad as it sounds. I've saved my strongest reason for the last. Dears, I've been spoiled. In 1916, a bath once a week is considered enough by most people, too much by some. Other habits match. Such thing, when unavoidable, can be ignored. I'm well aware that I whiff like an old billy goat in very short order myself. Nevertheless, when I have enjoyed the company of six of the daintiest darlings in the galaxy, well, I'd rather wait. Shucks, 10 years isn't long. If you have received any of the letters I will send over the next 10 years, then you may have rushed to check up on Gregorian 1916-1919. I selected 1919-1929 both to savor it, a vintage decade, the very last happy period in old Earth's history, but also to avoid the first of the Terran Planetary Wars. The one known now, it has already started, as the European War, then will be called the World War, then still later, the First World War, and designated in most ancient histories as Phase 1 of the First Terran Planetary War. Don't fret, I'm going to give it a wide berth. This involves changes in my travel plans, but none in the 1926 pickup. I have little memory of this war. I was too young. But I recall, probably from school lessons rather than from direct memory, that this country got into it in 1917, and that the war ended the following year. And that date I remember exactly, as it was my sixth birthday. And I thought the noise and celebration was for me. What I can't remember is the exact date this country entered the war. I may not have looked it up in planning this junket. My purpose was to arrive after 11 November 1918, the day the war ended, and I allowed what I thought was a comfortable margin. I was fitting in those 10 years most carefully, as the following 10 years, 1929-1939, are decidedly not a vintage decade, and they end with the start of Phase 2 of the First Terran Planetary War. There is no possible way for me to look up that date, but I find one bright clue in my memory, a phrase, the guns of August. That phrase has a sharp association in my memory with this war, and it fits, for I remember that it was warm, summery weather. August is summer here, when Gramp, your maternal grandfather, dears, took me out into the backyard and explained to me what war is and why we must win. I don't think he made me understand it, but I remember the occasion. I remember his serious manner. I remember the weather, warm, and the time of day, just before supper. Very well. I'll expect this country to declare war next August. I'll duck for cover in July, for I have no interest in this war. I know which side won, the side this country will be on, but I also know that the war to end all wars, it was called that, was a disastrous defeat both for victors and vanquished. It led, inevitably, to the great collapse and caused me to get off this planet. Nothing I can do will change any of that. There are no paradoxes. So, I will hole up till it's over. Almost every nation on Terra eventually picked sides, but many did no fighting, and the war did not get close to them, especially nations south of here, Central and South America. So, that is probably where I will go. But I have almost... Central and South America. So, that is probably where I will go. But I have almost a year to plan it. It is easy here to be anything you claim to be. No identification cards, no computer codes, no thumbprints, no tax numbers. Mind you, this planet now has as many people as Secundus has. Will have. Your now. Yet births are not even registered in much of this country. Mine was not, other than with the families. And a man is whoever he says he is. There are no formalities about leaving this country. It is slightly more difficult to get back in, but I have endless time to cope with that. But I should, through ordinary prudence, go away for the duration of this war. Why? Conscription. I'm darned if I'll try to explain that term to girls who just barely know what a war is, but it means slave armies. And it means to me that I should have asked Ishtar to make me look at least twice the apparent age I look now. If I hang around here too long, I risk becoming an involuntary hero in a war that was over before I was old enough to go to school. This strikes me as ridiculous. So, I'll concentrate on accumulating money to carry me a couple of years, convert that into gold, about 8 kilos, not too heavy. Then the 1st of next July, move south. A mild problem, then, is this country is conducting a small-scale border war with the one just south of it. Going north is out of the question. That country is already in a big war. The ocean to the east has underwater warships in it. These tend to shoot at anything that floats. But the ocean on the other side is free of such vermin. If I take a ship going south from a seaport on the west side of this country, I'll wind up outside the fighting zones. In the meantime, I must improve my Spanish. Much like Galacta, but prettier. I'll find a tutor. No, Laz, not a horizontal one. Don't you ever think about anything else? Come to think of it, dear, what else is worth thinking about? Money? Yes, money, at the moment, and I have plans for that. The country is about to elect a chief of government, and I am the only man on Terra who knows who will be elected. Why did it stick in my memory? Take a look at my registered family's name. So my pressing problem is to lay hands on money to bet on that election. What I win, I'll use to gamble in the bourse. Except that it won't be gambling, as this country is already in a war economy, and I know it will continue. I wish I could accept bets on the election instead of placing them, but that is too risky to my skin. I don't have the right political connections. You see, I'd better explain how this city is organized. Kansas City is a pleasant place. It has tree-shaded streets, lovely residential neighborhoods, a boulevard, and a park system known throughout the planet. Its excellent paving encourages the automobile carriages that are beginning to be popular. Most of this country is still deep in mud. Kansas City's well-paved streets have more of these auto-propelled vehicles than horse-drawn ones. The city is prosperous, being the second largest market and transportation center of the most productive agricultural area on Terra. Grain, beef, pork. The unsightly aspects of this trade are down in river bottoms, while the citizens live in beautiful wooded hills. On a damp morning when the wind sets from that quarter, one sometimes catches a whiff of stockyards. Otherwise, the air is clear and clean and beautiful. It is a quiet city. Traffic is never dense, and the clop-clop of horses' hooves or the warning gong of an electrically propelled street railroad car is just enough to accent the silence. The sounds of children at play are louder. Galahad is more interested in how a culture uses its leisure than in its economics, and so am I, as scratching a living is controlled by circumstances, but not play. By play, I do not mean sex. Sex can't take up too much time of humans matured beyond adolescence, except a few oddities, like the fabled Casanova, and Galahad, of course, may add off to the Duke. In 1916, nothing I say necessarily applies 10 years later, and certainly not 100 years later. This is the very end of an era. At this time, the typical Kansas Cityan makes his own play. His own social events are associated with churches, or with relatives by blood or marriage, or both. Dining, picnicking, playing games, not gambling, or simply visiting and talking. Most of this costs little or nothing except the expense of supporting their churches, which are social clubs as much as they are temples of religious faith. The major commercial entertainment is called moving pictures, dramatic shows presented as silent black and white shadow pictures flickering against the blank wall. These are quite new, very popular, and very cheap. They are called nickel shows, after the minor coin charged as a fee. Each neighborhood, defined as walking distance, has at least one such theater. This form of entertainment and its technological derivatives eventually had, will have, as much to do with the destruction of this social pattern as the automobile carriages. Get Galahad's opinion on this, but in 1916 neither has yet disturbed what appears to be a stable and rather utopian pattern. Anomie has not yet set in. The norms are strong, customs are binding, and no one here and now would believe that the occasional rumble is Cheney Stokes' breathing of the culture about to die. Literacy is at the highest level this culture will ever attain. My dears, the people of 1916 simply would not believe 2016. They won't even believe that they are about to be enmeshed in the first of the great final wars. That is why the man for whom I am named is about to be reelected. We are neutral. Too proud to fight. He kept us out of war. Under these slogans, they are marching over the precipice, not knowing it is there. You know, I'm depressing myself. Hindsight is a vice, especially when it is foresight. Now, let's look at the underside of this lovely city. The city is a nominal democracy. In fact, it is nothing of the sort. It is governed by one politician who holds no office. Elections are solemn rituals, and the outcomes are what he ordains. The streets are beautifully paved because his companies pave them to his profit. The schools are excellent, and they actually teach because this monarch wants it that way. He is pragmatically benign and does not overreach. Crime, which means anything illegal, and includes both prostitution and gambling, is franchised through his lieutenants. He never touches it himself. Much of this crime, by definition, is handled by an organization sometimes called the Black Hand. But in 1916, it usually has no name and is never seen. But it is why I don't dare accept election bets. I would be encroaching on a monopoly of one of this politician's lieutenants, which would be very dangerous to my health. Instead, I'll bet by the local rules and keep my mouth shut. The respectable citizen, with his pleasant home and garden and church and happy children, sees none of this, and I think suspects little of it, and thinks about it less. The city is divided into zones with firm though unmarked bounds. The descendants of former slaves live in a zone that forms a buffer between the nice part of town and the area dominated by and lived in by the franchised monopolists of such things as gambling and prostitution. At night, the zones mix only under unspoken conventions. In the daytime, there is nothing to notice. The boss maintains tight discipline, but keeps it simple. I've heard that he has only three unbreakable rules. Keep the streets well paved. Don't touch the schools. Don't kill anyone south of a certain street. In 1916, it works just fine. But not much longer. I must stop. I have an appointment at KC Photo Supply Company to use a lab in private. Then I must get back to the grift, separating people from dollars painlessly and fairly legally. Love forever, and all the way back. L. P.S. You should see me in a derby hat. The Capo 3. Maureen. Mr. Theodore Bronson, now Woodrow Wilson Smith, a.k.a. Lazarus Long, left his apartment on Armour Boulevard and drove his car, a Ford Landaulette, to a corner on 31st Street, where he parked it in a shed behind a pawn shop, as he took a dim view of leaving an automobile on the street at night. Not that the car had cost Lazarus much. He had acquired it as a result of the belief of an optimist from Denver that aces back-to-back plus a pair showing could certainly beat a pair of jacks. Mr. Jenkins must be bluffing, but Mr. Jenkins had a jack in the hole. It had been a profitable winter, and Lazarus expected a still more prosperous spring. His guess about a war market on certain stocks and commodities had usually been correct, and his spread of investments was wide enough that a wrong guess did not hurt him much, as most of his guesses were right. They could hardly be wrong, since he had anticipated stepped-up submarine warfare, knowing what would eventually bring this country into the war in Europe. Watching the market left him time for other investments in other people's optimism, sometimes at pool, sometimes at cards. He enjoyed pool more, found cards more rewarding. All winter he had played both, and his plain and rather friendly face, when decorated with his best stupid look, marked him as a natural sucker, a look he enhanced by dressing as a hayseed come to town. Lazarus did not mind other pool hall hustlers, or mechanics in card games, or reader cards. He simply kept quiet and accepted any build-up winnings offered him, then lost his nerve and dropped out before the kill. He enjoyed these crooked games. It was easier and pleasanter to take money from a thief than it was to play an honest game to win, and it did not cost as much sleep. He always dropped out of a crooked game early, even when he was behind, but his timing was rarely that bad. Winnings he reinvested in the market. All winter he had stayed Red Jenkins, living at the YMCA and spending almost nothing. When the weather was very bad, he stayed in and read, avoiding the steep and icy streets. He had forgotten how harsh a Kansas City winter could be. Once, he saw a team of big horses trying gallantly to haul a heavy truck up a steep pitch of 10th Street above Grand Avenue. The off-horse slipped on the ice and broke a leg. Lazarus heard the cannon bone pop. It made him feel sick, and he wanted to horsewhip the teamster. Why hadn't the fool taken the long way around? Such days were best spent in his room, or in the main public library near the YMCA. Hundreds of thousands of real books, bound books, he could hold in his hands. They tempted him almost into neglecting his pursuit of money. During that cruel winter, he spent every spare hour there, getting reacquainted with his oldest friends, Mark Twain, with Dan Beard's illustrations, Dr. Conan Doyle, the marvelous land of Oz, as described by the royal historian and portrayed in color by John R. Neal, Rudyard Kipling, Herbert George Wells, Jules Verne. Lazarus felt he could easily spend all the coming 10 years in that wonderful building. But when false spring arrived, he started thinking about moving out of the business district and again changing his persona. It was becoming difficult to get picked as a sucker, either at pool or at poker. His investment program was complete. He had enough cash in Fidelity Savings and Trust Bank to allow him to give up the austerity of the YMCA, find a better address, and show a more prosperous face to the world, essential to his final purpose in this city, re-meeting his first family. And not much time left before his July deadline. Acquiring a presentable motor car crystallized his plans. He spent the next day becoming Theodore Bronson, moved his bank account one street over to the Missouri Savings Bank, and held out ample cash. Visited a barber and had his hair and mustache restyled. Went to Browning King & Company and bought clothing suitable to a conservative young businessman. Then he drove south and cruised Linwood Boulevard, watching for vacancy signs. His requirements were simple. A furnished apartment with a respectable address and facade, its own kitchen and bathroom, and in walking distance of a pool hall on 31st Street.